Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 808th episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. Welcome, welcome, everybody. Greg Peterson here from Urban Farm U. And tonight we have our March Garden Chat. And we've got Charlotte Wiggins here this evening, how to help pollinators. Ever wonder about pollinators and their impact on our environment? Why are they important and how do they impact the environment around us? That's what we're talking about tonight. Charlotte Ecker Wiggins is an award-winning author, lecturer, master beekeeper, and master gardener. After careers in journalism with the U.S. Forest Service and the U.S. Navy, she's now chairing an 8-state Midwest partnership to grow beekeeping instructors teaching scientifically based best management practices. Her 42-year-old, and I want to talk about that actually, your 42-year-old one-acre garden where her neighbors said nothing would grow is a Monarch Way Station, certified wildlife habitat and apiary. She featured how she developed bluebird gardens in her April 2019 TED Talk, Why Bugs Matter. She's the author of two reference books, Bee Club Basics, How to Start a Bee Club, and Beekeeper's Diary, Self-Guide to Keeping Bees. Welcome tonight, Charlotte.
Thank you, Greg. I look forward to this evening and the conversation.
Yeah. 2-year-old garden. You've been at the garden for 42 years.
We built this house in 1982. It was a 1-acre subdivision acre out of 96 acres. And they never finished the subdivision because it's on the side of a hill. Nobody in their right would build here except us, my husband at the time and I. And the neighbors said they thought it was funny that I wanted to put a garden. They said nothing's going to grow there. And they weren't wrong. It was a challenge to get this garden to be established, but it taught me a lot. It taught me to appreciate the natives that were already growing here. It taught me that soil was the most important thing that I needed to take care of. It didn't matter what I planted. The soil was what I needed to focus on. And I have planted dwarf fruit trees and I have some plants that I like, but right now it's just covered in daffodils. It's just lovely.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Because I've got oak trees, I have more of an acidic soil versus the more alkaline kind of soil. So the daffodils love that kind of soil.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I'm in Asheville these days. And we were lucky if we ever saw a daffodil in Phoenix, Arizona. But right now, this month, halfway through March, they are thousands and thousands of them everywhere. It's amazing.
And they're beautiful. And I don't know about where you are, but I'm in mid-Missouri. I call it the belly button of the state, right in the Midwest. USDA growing zone 6A, zone 8. And I have plants growing a good month to 6 weeks early. I have French lilacs in bloom, which is normally doesn't happen until after Easter.
Interesting.
It's in April.
Yeah.
We've had a very mild winter and we've had an early spring. Of course, tonight the temperatures are going to be going down into the 20s. Easter's already here, but the temperature fluctuations are pretty extreme. And so right after this, I'm going to go outside and throw a sheet over a couple of my dwarf fruit trees, hoping that they'll make it through it. It's a seesaw experience now with a rapidly changing climate. You never know from one day to the next what's going to happen.
About 25 years ago, a friend of mine and I developed a planting calendar for the low desert in Phoenix. And along about 2019, we looked at the calendar and it was no longer accurate.
You know,
we had to do something about it. So we updated it. And that was a bit of an eye-opener for me.
You know, well, I kept a diary noting things like when my first crocus bloom, certain things that I like to look at and see And it has changed over 40 years significantly. You used to be able to count on crocus on Valentine's Day, February 14th. And the early daffodils would start on March 21st. It's out the window now. Can't use that anymore.
Well, we take a deep breath and keep moving on. Yay
Absolutely.
for the So we're talking about pollinators tonight. And in my bio that I read for you, Monarch Way Station, Certified Wildlife Habitat and Apiary. Tell me about what that means for pollinators for your property.
So when I started this garden, I wasn't a master gardener, but I wanted to attract pollinators. I lived in South America off the coast of Brazil and in the jungle on an island in a jungle area. So I had a very close affinity to nature and to watching what was happening in nature. We used plants there for medicinal purposes because we didn't have a pharmacy, a doctor nearby. And so when I established myself here in Missouri, I wanted to have that same affinity with the garden. And that meant encouraging birds into my garden. It meant encouraging butterflies. It meant seeing plants that had bugs on them versus perfect plants. I've never sought perfection in my garden, but I've liked the idea of balance in the garden. And so the National Wildlife Federation had this wonderful certification program, which said, if you do these things, you can be certified. I used that list as a guide to make sure I had those things in my garden. I had bird baths that had water for the pollinators. I put sand in some of the bird baths and made sure it had water through the year for the butterflies to safely land on sticks that were in the sand. That was a great way to say, oh, I need to add milkweed if I want to have a monarch way station. I need to make sure I have tons of things flowering if I want to have an apiary. So those certification processes are a nice guide if you're starting, or even if you've already been gardening for a while, but you get a sense for what your pollinators need by looking through those guides. It
Nice.
also did something for my neighbors. My neighbors, one of them in particular, had immaculately planted and groomed turf grass. No dandelion dared step foot in his garden. He's up the hill. And I don't have a blade of grass on my 1 acre. And he used to get excited about that. And I would say, I'm a certified wildlife habitat. I have plants everywhere. I want to be able to feed the butterflies. And that helped him understand that his vision of beauty and my vision of beauty were very different, but that we could coexist. As long as the dandelions didn't step in his yard, he was fine with that.
Yeah, and there are lots of dandelions here. That's
Oh my, I bet there are.
what okay, so what good are dandelions for our pollinator habitat?
So they're an early blooming herb, and when they bloom, there's not much else that's blooming, and so they provide a food source for pollinators, not just bees, native bees and honeybees, but there's some butterflies as well. The root of the dandelion is also very long, and so that dandelion plant helps with soil production and management and making sure water gets down deeper into the bottom layers of the soil. So there have lots of benefits for dandelions. As a matter of fact, in the 1800s, people were tearing up their lawn to plant dandelions. And when the European settlers came to North America in the 1600s, they brought two things that were growing plants that were primarily a foundation of their homes. They brought the dandelions, that was their apothecary, their medicine cabinet, and they brought orange daylily roots because you can eat the whole root, the whole plant. And today, when you look at kitchen gardens in Europe, you'll still find daylilies, orange daylilies growing in their gardens because they can eat the whole plant. Poor man's asparagus. The stems of the daylilies are called poor man's asparagus.
So, what is a certified wildlife habitat?
So the National Wildlife Federation has a certification program. They were one of the few that had it years ago when I followed their certification process, just to guide me on what I needed to have in my garden to be able to feed pollinators. Now, if you look at the monarchs, they actually have, just like hummingbirds, they have a route that they take where it takes them 4 generations to get from maybe the northern part of the US down to Mexico where they winter over. And we had a terrible year last year, a high mortality rate. I'll be surprised if they're not on the endangered species list here shortly. But for years, I could sit on the back of my house. This is before I was certified or before I was a Monarch Way Station. And in the fall, I could watch them flying around my house on as they were headed south. So I already knew they were here or that I was in their pathway. So I added milkweed that was native to Missouri along the backside of my property so they would have a food source as they're migrating. About 10 years ago, we almost made a big mistake in this country. We allowed people to plant any milkweed without explaining. The tropical milkweed is very hardy. The problem with that is the monarch butterflies depend on the native plants to guide them as they're migrating. So as soon as the food source ends here, that tells them that they need to go farther south to find food and to metamorphize. Well, a couple of years we had the tropical milkweed planted all over the place. The monarchs didn't go anywhere. They had a constant food source and they died when the temperatures dropped. And so it's really important to know that your native plantings are part of the ecosystem calendar. And when things stop blooming where you are, native things stop blooming, that's an indicator to your native species that may either migrate or need to hibernate that the food source is gone. And then that helps them trigger do something else.
Wow. That so my partner Heidi has been looking at for different kind of milkweeds, and she stated that we didn't want the non-native versions, and now I can share with her why. So what plants are best for attracting pollinators? And I assume part of it is going to be natives.
Absolutely. Particularly trees, and shrubs. They have the most nectar and pollen available, especially if you're looking at your native bees. And your butterflies are going to be interested in specific species like Fritillaria butterflies, like your wild violets. A lot of people think of the wild violets as being weeds. I don't use that four-letter word anymore, because I've tried to understand the plants that grow here because I wasn't raised here, but there tend to be herbs. They're herbs that we've forgotten, have lost their popularity for whatever reason. And so I love wild violets and I bring them in. And I have to tell you that there was a migration year, a year, I don't want to say 5 years ago, where painted ladies were migrating through the US. It was a huge migration. And I had autumn sedum. I have autumn sedum growing in my garden because I love the plant and it's easy to grow and it has beautiful flowers during the different seasons. And of course, it's food for pollinators. I remember going out one afternoon and my whole garden was just covered in painted lady butterflies. They were migrating. And I happen to have the food source for them. So it's important to understand that there are certain plants are going to be food source for certain pollinators. You can't just plant one necessarily. You need to understand what pollinators are in your region and then make sure you're planting for those pollinators. But if you don't know, just plant natives because that's good, for sure going to feed a percentage of them.
Yeah, big time. And both your books are around beekeeping. And when you're talking in your books about beekeeping, you're talking about honeybees, correct?
Well, a beekeeper's diary is more than that. Yes, it's primarily a honeybee book, but it also has a chapter on planting for bees, native bees, as well as honeybees. Because frankly, well, three-fourths of the world's plants rely on pollination. Majority of that are honeybees. We become an agricultural-based society that depends on those honeybees for pollination. The native bees are better pollinators, but they're not as around as often or as long as the honeybees are. Honeybees are around year-round. The native bees hibernate for a period of time. So, Keeper's Diary talks about planting for pollinators. The first chapter is about planting for pollinators, the kinds of plants that you can plant in your garden. And then the rest of it has to do with raising honeybees. I'm writing a third book, though, it's going to call Bees Need Flowers, Planting for Pollinators. That'll go into more on that planting side and how to support pollinators.
So let's go back. We already talked about a couple of different pollinator plants. What are some of your favorite plants to plant for pollinators? And I'm going to actually start this by saying when I was in Phoenix, I had an oregano plant that was growing in my front yard. Yeah. And it was easily 5 foot by 5 foot. It had taken over a corner of my yard. And when it was flowering, there were thousands of pollinators on it.
I believe it. I have oregano as a ground cover in my retaining wall. And people sometimes go by and they go, is that oregano? And I go, yes. And I don't explain. Because like you said, when they flower, they attract pollinators. There are six plant families primarily that'll give you nectar and pollen, which basically feeds pollinators. They need nectar for flight fuel, and they need pollen as protein. And oregano, like herbs, are one of the plant families that feed pollinators. Another one is the figwort family. Think of butterfly bushes. They just reclassified some of those plants a few years back. So that plant family is a lot smaller than it used to be. But mullein is out of that. If you think of the lovely, very soft leaves, the gray leaves that are mullein, you see them on the side of the roads a lot of time in the Midwest. And the flower stalk, it has yellow flowers on it. Wonderful plant for pollinators. And we tend to either mow over them or dig them up. But if you let them grow undisturbed, they will have a little colony that will grow. And that will be a stunning display of yellow flowers that attracts a ton of butterflies in. You have legumes. So those are the cover crops.
Mm-hmm.
About red clover for bumblebees and red crimson clover for honeybees. Honeybees don't have a tongue long enough to get to the nectar in the red clover. And so I always say to people, if you're going to go buy things, whether it's seeds or plants, make sure you have the Latin name. You don't have to pronounce it. Just write it down so that you're not buying the wrong thing. You want to make sure that if you're buying red clover, and the beekeepers will say, red clover is a great ground cover. They're talking about the crimson clover because that's what honeybees can access. But white clover, those peas, sweet peas, and the peas that you like to grow, I know they vary around the country for decoration. Those are mm-hmm. also excellent plants for pollinators. Let's see. I've gone through. Oh, asters. The daisy-like flowers, the whole aster family is a wonderful plant family for pollinators. Think about daisies. Think about the center of the daisy that makes it easy access for the plant to produce the nectar that attracts the pollinator. And then they can then move the pollen around, whether it's a strawberry. Strawberry has both the male and female parts. And so the pollinator is just basically moving the pollen a little bit. But then you have plants that have male and female plants. And so the pollinators move the pollen from one plant to the next plant. But there are lots of plants in the aster family, in particular, the New England aster. I'm thinking of plants that have a North American territory. And mm-hmm. the New England aster is a wonderful pollinator plant for late summer and fall. I had one that grew that was blooming here through January one year, a few years back.
Wow. Because,
again, we're getting our temperatures are getting warmer here. Our winters are getting milder. But there, so that you can look at those plant families and then select from within the plant families plants to plant that'll help your pollinators. Corn's not going to do anything for your pollinators.
Because it's self-pollinating.
Soybeans not going to do. And soybeans may feed your honeybees a little bit, but you're not going to get as much pollen and nectar out of those plants for your pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
See, the plants themselves don't produce a given amount of nectar and a given amount of pollen. There's some plants that only produce nectar for a certain time. Buckwheat, for example, I call it bee coffee. They produce nectar here in the morning, early morning, because uh-huh. I've had people say, oh, I planted buckwheat and I never saw any bees on it. And I've said, well, were you out there at 7 o'clock in the morning? No, you need to go out there before 10 o'clock. You'll see bees all over that. But around 10-ish, the plant shuts off that spigot, puts a coffee pot away, and then the bees have got to go find the nectar someplace else. Some plants produce nectar only on certain temperatures. Plants only want to reproduce a certain time of the year, and so they don't produce any nectar. Maybe some other pollinator was there before your butterfly or your bee. So there's so many other factors that play into whether or not this plant is going to feed pollinators. I just tell people, keep on planting. Just keep on planting. You're not going to be able to control what's in your garden. And if you think of 1 pound of honey, which is what most people buy at a store, that's really flower nectar that they're picking up. The bees don't make that. They collect it. And yes, they do mix some enzymes in it, but they're not altering that flower nectar. They're dehydrating it. They dehydrate it to 18%, and then they store it for their winter food. And we as beekeepers are collecting extra honey. But that 1 pound of honey that you buy at your store for, I don't know, $15, that's the essence of 2 million flowers. And if you
think
about, yes, that's 2 million flowers. They've dehydrated, they've collected the nectar of 2 million flowers to make that 1 pound of honey.
Hardest workers on the planet.
Absolutely. And when you think about one colony living through the year, so you've got spring, summer, fall, winter, with 50,000 bees, that's the average size of a colony, they need 700 pounds of honey just for them. That doesn't count any extra that the beekeeper might collect. That's 1,400,000,000 flowers.
Wow.
I just keep saying to people, I don't know how many zeros that is, but just keep planting. The native bees also need food, but they need food in a smaller window. And the problem with that is, like today, tonight's going to be 20 degrees here. And my fruit trees have already flowered, but my little native bees are still hibernating because it's been too cold for them. And so when they finally come out of hibernation, they're going to miss the fruit tree window because the fruit trees have bloomed early. But I will have other things in the garden blooming, hopefully to feed them. So we can't control weather. We can provide organic material compost for our soils, but there's so many factors that we can't control, so many things that we don't know. Plants themselves have different colors that guide the pollinators in. The pollinators see a flower different than we do. We may see it as blue, but they may see it as ultraviolet. As far as I'm concerned, it's too complicated. So just keep on planting. Plant natives, and that will then make sure that you're providing food sources for your pollinators. I like things simple.
Exactly. One of the things that, coming from Phoenix, Arizona, to here, in Phoenix, in the low desert, we had a few things blooming throughout the year. What I've noticed here in Asheville, North Carolina, is that starting in early February, you said violas, right?
Yes.
We had some of them pop, and they look almost like fake plants, don't they?
They do.
They're small and purple and amazing.
Yeah. Yes.
And so they, in mid-February, they start. And one of the things we've noticed is that really through December, there's going to be something flowering.
That's true. Yeah. And those wild violets are edible.
Oh.
You can eat the young leaves, put in a salad, but the flowers have a nutty flavor, a lemony nutty flavor that they add. So you just pull the, assuming you're not treating it with any chemicals, you can just pull the little flowers out and put them on your salad plate and add a little flavor to your salads.
Nice. They're so pretty.
I know. Eastern red buds, they're blooming right now, and their range is North America. So you can plant an Eastern redbud almost anywhere. They're beautiful here right now, and they're edible. Those flowers are edible. I sprinkle some of the flowers on my salads just to remind myself I'm in spring and enjoying the redbud season.
And the redbud's a massive tree that blooms white?
No, they bloom pink. At this time of year, their flowers are pink, and then the little leaves come out and they look like little hearts.
Ah.
A lot of people don't plant them because they can be destroyed in storms. Their trunks are not very strong, but I've actually trained them. I've used rebar to keep them straight as when they were young. And so most of mine are growing more straight than other red buds. And so they can tolerate storms better because I've forced their trunks to be less than gnarly and not less thin than they would normally grow. And then I also trim them to keep the branches bushy, but they're lovely. I feel like I'm in a haze of pink right now. My whole 1 acre is just surrounded in red buds that naturally grow here. I remember thinking 1 year, why am I fighting these? Why am I not just embracing what's already growing here? And that's when I started to train them. And now people come by and they want to know what kind of exotic plant this is, what it's
And
like.
it's a native.
And I'll always say, you want to start? I'll go dig one. I can just go take a little trowel and find one on the hillside.
Nice. So tell me how your book happened.
Oh, easy. So I started beekeeping in 2010. And this was my plan back then. I was going to get one hive, maybe two. I was going to set up the back 40 because I heard about stinging and all the fear of stinging, whatever. And I was going to let the bees take care of themselves. And then we would have a meeting a couple times a year and everything would be good. I didn't count on falling in love. I was fascinated when I started going to a local club and learning about all of the ins and outs of beekeeping. The more I know, the more I realize I don't know. And it was a struggle because we didn't have anybody around where I live that really taught you or mentored you. So it was a trial by fire. And I met a gentleman at one of those club meetings who volunteered to help me when the extension office asked me to teach a beginning beekeeping class. And so I did that. And the end of that class, somebody said, can you start a club to support us who want to start beekeeping? So this gentleman helped me. His name's David. We call ourselves Bee Buddies. And so we started the process of helping other people with beekeeping. And in doing that, when I was starting those classes, I used to have handouts. And then the handouts became a little more detailed series of papers I hunted. Then it became a loose leaf binder. And then one fall, you can never make copies that end up the same number. I don't care. I've never been able to come out with the same numbers I put in. It was just too much. And I said, I'm just going to do a book because somebody said, well, you can self-publish. I thought that would be easy. I'll just self-publish this little handout. And as I started putting the handouts together, I realized I was writing the book that I would have liked to have had when I started beekeeping.
Oh, nice.
And when I've asked people to read it who are beekeepers, people like Kim Flottam, who was the unfortunately deceased now, but he was the longtime editor of Bee Culture magazine. Not only did he say this is the kind of book he would have liked to have had started, but he said I was revolutionizing the way beekeeping is taught because I started talking about plants before I even talked about the bees. I would say you have to decide where to put your hives, but you have to make sure your bees are getting food. And that means understanding a little bit about plants and about what's growing within a 2 mile radius of where you're placing your hives. So I still look at that book periodically and say, what have I missed? And haven't missed much. Most people seem to be able to use it successfully to get started. It is based on scientifically based principles from the Great Plains Master Beekeeping Program, plus experience. So, one of the favorite items that people have out of that book is how to secure the foundation. You have frames, movable frames, and a foundation in. And instead of buying these expensive little pins, I use bobby pins because I'm a girl. And more people will comment about that's a great tip. So I have a combination of experience and then the background to that. And then that book now has become a study guide for the students who are going through the Master Beekeeping program. But that's how it got started.
Nice. It's called A Beekeeper's Diary, Self-Guide to Keeping Bees. When did you first put it out?
2021.
Oh, okay. So
And
it's fairly new.
yes, and the reason we call this is the second edition, so that was 2022. The reason we call self-guide is we also know that there are parts of the country people can't access Zoom or online lectures and can't find a club, but they still want to keep bees. And this book actually has, I'm a list maker, but it has lists of the decisions you have to make on the critical parts of establishing yourself as a beekeeper. For example, there are 14 different decisions you have to make on where to place your hives. And so not only is that list there, but it says these are the things you have to consider and you double check. And so if they can't go to somebody, they can't find a mentor, or they can't go to a club, they can take that book and they can start because the guide is there, how to start, keep a smoker going. You're putting a fire in a 16-ounce tin can, basically. And there's a guide there about the kind of fuels you can use and how to do it, and what, make sure the parts that you have. And those are things that are not in many other books. I read 60 plus beginning beekeeping books before I started writing mine and said there are parts here missing. And Kim agreed with me. That was nice to have him read and go, my gosh. And he said to me, when you've been teaching, you've been keeping bees for 35, 40, 50 years, you forget how hard it is for somebody to start that fire in a smoker, or to remember to keep a hive tool in your hand at all times. After a while, it becomes habit and second nature. But when you're experienced, you forget that's an issue for a beginning beekeeper.
Yeah, I had that experience when I moved to Asheville on my first garden. I planted my first garden in 1975 in Phoenix, Arizona, and had gardens until I left in 2022. And I landed here, and my first garden here was a miserable failure.
Oh, I'm just, the first one usually is. Like, And the other thing that's interesting is, especially with beginning beekeeping, we always tell people your first year with your bees may not be very successful. And don't get excited. Learn from the, if your colony dies, we call it dead out CSI. It's called dead out. And we just did a little session in our club meeting where we tell people, bring us pictures of what happened, what was on the bottom of the hive, what was on the different drawers, if you're not a beekeeper, the different supers of your hive. Take pictures of your frames, and then we'll go through and we'll talk about what may have happened. Learn from the mistake. Don't, yes, it's devastating. I've been doing this 15 years and I'm still devastated if I lose a colony, but learn from it. Learn to learn from it. Learn to say, this is going to be a learning experience so that you don't do it again.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, and where can we find your book at?
Oh, that's on Amazon. And if you want an autographed copy, you can go to Bluebird Gardens. That's my custom gift business. And I sell the books to Bluebird Gardens with autographs.
Cool. And what's that website?
Bluebirdgardens.com.
Nice. And why did you name your garden?
I live on Bluebird Lane.
Oh, nice.
And so when I started, matter of fact, this was named Vista Drive because it has a beautiful view the hillside. And the city decided to change the name and name the street up the hill from me, Vista. And they gave me the opportunity to name my street.
Whoa. You got to name your own street?
Yes, I did.
How cool is
I wanted it
that?
to be named Lizard Ridge because that's what I used to use in my Christmas cards. Merry Christmas from Lizard Ridge. I love lizards. We have lots of them around here. They're beautiful. The city engineer said nobody was going to buy the house sitting on Lizard Ridge. So I had to go through 27 other names, all rejected. You didn't need to, we had deer. You can't have anything with deer. I have cardinals living. No, nothing. Too many cardinals. I forget. Raccoon, run. I threw some really silly ones in there because I was l running out of names. And then one day I'm sitting out on my porch drinking my tea, and this little bluebird comes down and she plays in the water and then takes off. And I said, Bluebird, how about Bluebird Lane? And they ex accepted that finally, but it was not an easy process.
Nice. And I want to dive in just a little bit deeper into decisions. Like, what's the first three decisions you have to make in getting bees?
The first one for sure is what will they eat? because you cannot artificially feed your bees for any length of time. You can do it for a short time, but you need to make sure that they know that you know what they're going to be able to access. The second one is for you to decide if you can get over your fear. There is no doubt that we are scared to death starting in beekeeping. And so when you're scared to death, bees communicate and also run through life based on pheromones. They don't have very good eyesight, but they have their antenna, they have little sensors on their feet, and they communicate with pheromones. And so when we show fear, we put off a pheromone that tells the bees that you're fearful, just like horses could pick up on that as well. So you have to get over that fear. You have to understand that, yes, it's not if you're going to get stung, it's when you're going to get stung. And you're going to get stung because you've done something harebrained, not because the bees are coming after you. They have to feel threatened by what you're doing. And then they'll sting you, and they sting once and then they die. So they're not going to do it unless, say, there's something that doesn't jive with what their world should be. So getting over that fear, and we have a teaching apiary here, and the Great Plains Master Beekeeping Program is developing teaching apiaries to the Midwest, because we want you to come out to a teaching apiary, put on a suit, and stick your gloved hand into a hive and look at a bee eye to eye. Once you do that and you start realizing how cool they are, how interesting they are, what they do for us, what you can do for them, you forget you're fearful. Because in most cases, if you're doing what we tell you to do, move slowly, this is how you move the frame, this is how you manipulate the hive boxes, they're not going to sting you. So wear your safety equipment and go get that experience. Maybe you have a beekeeper in your community and ask them if they can come out. You can come out to their hive someday and go come look at the bees. Get that familiarity so you get that fear out. And then the third thing is go to classes. Don't start beekeeping without some education. It is not an easy hobby. It is expensive, $1,000 to get into it. And so invest in your education first and get to know some bee biology and then get yourself some bees. There's a wonderful program called Heroes to Hives out of Michigan, which is actually worldwide. They are providing beginning beekeeping training for military families and re retirees. And they say go through 1 year of education, which they provide for free, and then get your bees your second year. And I would reiterate that advice. I think that's a very good approach.
Yeah, I've said for years, spend at least a year on a property before you make any changes. So that makes that,
Absolutely.
yeah, awesome. And any final thoughts?
Please keep planting, especially natives. If you're not a gardener, then planting native trees will make you feel like one, because those plants are already acclimated to your soil types, your weather conditions. Make sure to water them. I have a lot of people who say, well, I planted natives and they died. Did you water them? No, they're natives. You need, like babies, you need to feed them and water them the first year. And once they're established, though, they probably don't need as much water as maybe an exotic plant of some sort is. But keep planting and try your natives. They're easy. They're e much easier to grow. They already have established relationships with your local pollinators and your good garden bugs. And be kind to your soil. Compost. We throw 40% of our food away that could be turned into organic material to feed our soil. So those are my two pieces of advice.
Amen to that. Awesome. Thank you. A Beekeeper's Diary Self-Guide to Keeping Bees by Charlotte Ecker Wiggins. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.